Hi, everybody. I'm Liz Nord, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. When Israeli journalist Maya Zinstein took on a four-day assignment to cover the arrival of two foreign players to a local soccer club, she had no idea that it would turn into a year-long making of a feature documentary that dramatically reveals the skeletons in her own country's closet. But this was no ordinary soccer team, and this is certainly not your average sports documentary. The team at the center of the film is Beitar Jerusalem, which had been historically known for its fans' politically right-wing and even racist tendencies. An extreme wing of the team's fan base would sit together in a certain part of the stadium and pridefully chant, "We are the most racist team in Israel." In fact, it was the only team in Israel's Premier League never to sign an Arab player. In the course of the film, the team gets bought by a Russian oligarch who brings two Muslim players from Chechnya into the lineup to serve his own business needs. The resulting backlash exposes the ugliest parts of Israeli society, with some of the club's own lifetime fans turning against the new players, along with any of the old players or management who supported them, even turning to violence at times. Rarely does a documentary, especially about something as apparently innocuous as soccer, expose so many layers of one society, from race to class to politics to economics. But it didn't come without Zinstein's own battles. In our conversation, she's very candid about how she overcame the challenges she faced making the film, especially in trying to convince people to let her turn Verite cameras on them in the midst of personal and national crises. When we spoke, it was as the film premiered at last year's Toronto International Film Festival. Zinstein has since received everything from death threats to awards to a broadcast on America's renowned Independent Lens series on PBS. The first voice you will hear is Maya Zinstein's describing the film.
So it's a story about the most controversial football club in Israel. It's called Beitar Jerusalem. It's a Jewish-oriented club, and it's the only club in the Israeli Premier League that has never signed an Arab player. So in 2013, the owner, which is a Russian oligarch, decided to bring two Muslim players from Chechnya to join the club. And the fans started a huge protest against their own club, trying to stop this move, and in a way almost brought their own club to fall apart.
A lot of our listeners are American. We also have a whole international crew. But, you know, football isn't as big of a deal in the States. So what does football itself mean in Israel?
Actually, you prefer us to call it soccer?
Football, soccer, yeah.
Okay.
Football. Exactly. So soccer.
Yeah. Well, I think in Israel, it's the most famous game in Israel, for sure, that has the biggest fan bases. But also in Israel, soccer is maybe, and that's maybe very unique for Israel, actually all the clubs are came from political or youth movements. Because actually almost everything in Israel came from that. So Beitar was a youth movement that turned to be the Likud party, which is the right-wing party. So I think in Israel, the soccer is very, very political. And especially Beitar Jerusalem, it's a very ideological club. In a way, it says about you a lot if you are a Beitar fan. Mm-hmm. In a way, if you're a Beitar fan, so you're probably right-wing, you're usually coming from a certain social level, and it's also lots of it's your identity. I've been asking the Beitar fans, are you more football fan or Beitar fan, and the answer is always Beitar fan. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the football is just an excuse for something much bigger.
And so you live in Tel Aviv, which is a more liberal city, maybe a little bit more mixed in a way.
Yeah.
So how do people in Tel Aviv think about Beitar fans? You know, what's the kind of stereotype of Beitar Jerusalem fans?
First of all, it's very important that the uniqueness of Beitar, that it's not a local city club. So it's only 30% of the Beitar fans are coming actually from Jerusalem. 70% are from all over the country, because it's not about football. It's about your identity and your political views. So that's very important. It's there's Beitar fans everywhere. Usually, actually, they can be a fan of their local city club, but above that, it's Beitar, because Beitar, that's the, you know, that's the basics. That's from home. That's from who am I? I can move cities, but I cannot move from being a Beitar fan. So what I'm trying to say, in a way, there is a lot. Well, there is a fans of Beitar in Tel Aviv also, but I guess the stereotype would be right wing extremists, maybe. It's a very bad stereotypes. Maybe not. Not very educated. I think I hate this. Even though, I really hate this kind of way of thinking.
So the stereotypes bothered you, even though you sort of told in your story maybe why some of those stereotypes exist.
I think I'm trying to be, and it was too important to me, to be fair with them, like with all my characters. Because, you know, it's a very easy story to take it and to push it, really. Because, come on, it's crazy. I'm showing there are people that shouting, we're the most racist team in the country. People really attacking two football players because they're Muslims. That's really ugly. Mm-hmm. And for me as a filmmaker, it was really important not to kind to really take to deal with this really carefully, mm-hmm. because I kind of felt that I have a bomb in my hands, and for me it was really important to kind of to show the where it's can come from. I'm not saying that I agree with that, mm-hmm. but it's coming from, you know, as one of the Beitar fans saying in the film, we're a damaged society. We are a damaged society. And there is a reason why we are a damaged society. So, and for me, it was really important to bring into the film these reasons. And of course, at the end, I'm showing that it's crazy and that two football players are coming to play football, and then all this terrible thing happening. But I think it's not nobody born racist, you know. They are a product of their society, and they are a product of their period when they grew up. And for me, this to bring it in context, it was really important, because I don't want to help to these stereotypes to develop. I want to tell a story that is, for me, as someone that came from outside into the story, it was shocking. Mm. I maybe was really naive in a way that I was the first person that the Chechen players met when they arrived to Israel. Wow. Because I'm also a journalist, and I've been asked by a TV show to make a story about their arrival. But when I came with these players into, and I spent with them for the first 4 days, and I saw this mayhem, it was crazy. I was like, what the hell is going on here? Come on, it's just people.
At some point, you must have realized, A, this is going to be a film and not just a journalism piece.
Yeah.
And B, ooh, I'm stepping into it like a bee's nest. Here.
After 4 days, so I spent these 4 days and the story was shown on television, but I understood that actually the story has just begun, because I knew that they're going to stay, the Chechen players. And I saw the reaction. I said, oh my God, where is going to go all this story? And even though it's funny because the chairman of the club, it's a corn fine, told me, you'll see in 2 weeks, everything will be over. They will score some goals and the fans will accept them. And of course, what happened is exactly the opposite. And when one of the Chechen players or scores a goal, so the fans are leaving the stadium. So they never were accepted. And it was really, in a way, and there is hard for me heartbreaking scene when the mom, so the club decided to bring one of them for the one of the players. He brings them his mother because he was really suffering, and she says to him, "Make sure that you play well, and then the fans will love you." And that's terrible because she has no idea,
right?
That it's just
she was wrong.
It has zero chances. It really doesn't matter what they would do. It just, yeah.
So after that initial time with them, and when you started to see what was happening, you decided, oh, this is going to be a film.
So, yeah, so after these 4 days, so I came to the chairman, to Corin Fine, and said to him, listen, I think you're doing here something amazing, and I think it should be a film. He said to me, it's a great idea. Do you have anyone in mind that can do it? I said, yes, myself.
That's right.
Yeah, and then it was interesting because he said to me, okay, so what's the conditions? So I told him, everything is open. He said, and when I will watch the film? So I said, in the premiere. Mm. And actually, he watched the film in the premiere.
Wow. Well, we'll get to everyone's reactions later.
I really didn't expect that it will go. I was sure that it will be a film with a good end. Really. I was really believing that football is stronger than everything, that it's the biggest religion in the world. Mm. And it's connecting people, and if they would work, and if they will score some goals, the fans will accept them. And for me, it was a huge surprise also. And also for all the club, nobody thought that it will went so bad.
So I imagined when I saw the film that you must have kind of known what to expect. And like I said, that you were stepping into a bee's nest. But it sounds like it surprised you.
No. But, that's the beauty of documentary. That's why I so love documentary. Because you just, especially when you have this amazing chance to film Verité, which for me, of course, it's, that's like the holy grail of the documentary. And so you really can't know how it will end up.
Right. I always say it's a blessing and a curse.
Yes, of course.
So yeah. Then there
my wrinkles are...
Well, a good thing it's a podcast.
My face is showing how what a big curse it is.
I hear that. So then at some point during production, you must have thought, oh my God, this is not going how I expected. Did you have to ask yourself, do I really want to show this uglier story than I expected?
Well, it's never a question because I'm not a PR person. It's not a question. There was lots of other questions, but not that, because that's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm. So what other questions came up for you as you got further into the story?
Well, it was, when I told you that one of the conditions that I said to the chairman that everything is open, and then he said yes, I really quickly understood that I was really naive when I was thinking, in a way, I could come in into the... if. The fact that I can come in doesn't mean that I can film. Because then he was telling me, no, it's the decision of the coach. Come on, Maya, you cannot bother the coach. That's professional. So only if the coaches agree. And the coach had a club that is falling apart and a team that was just losing a game after game, and the last thing that he wanted is a camera in this thing, and that was really difficult because I also had a really short time. I had 3 months, which is nothing in a sense of documentary, mm-hmm. and I had 30 men running around me that I had no clue. So who's my characters? Really, who's my characters? What's the story? I cannot, you know, okay, so now I'm coming and I'm exploring. This one is interesting. This one is not. No. Everybody's running. Everybody has a really bad mood. Everybody told me, no. Really. Everybody will tell me, don't film. We don't want you here. Don't go. And I kind of could understand them because they had, it was people in crisis. And also, I think a very natural reaction of us is when something bad happens to you, you're just getting closer. You're not opening yourself. You're closing yourself. And of course, you don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. That was a big question because it was many filming days that I financed by myself because I decided to keep going by myself and I had no time to raise any money. And I knew I couldn't just, you know, say to myself, okay, I will wait, I will raise some money. No, it happens, it's just happening and you just need to film it. So most of the time I was saying to myself, what the hell I'm filming here? No, I really wasn't sure that I have a film for a long time. Even when I finished to film it, this season, I wasn't sure because it's just, there were so many problems of who's the character, why,
and what's the story?
Yeah, what's the story? Because after I finished the film, it took me time to understand what I filmed. Mm-hmm. Because when I was filming, I had no time to think about it.
Right.
And the working with my great cameraman, Israel Friedman, it was asking me, Maya, who's my characters? And I would tell them, I don't know. And so I finished the film and then I started to try to understand what actually I filmed and how I'm telling this story and what's the story that I want to tell. Because actually from the footage that I filmed, you could make 5 different films.
Sure. I think every documentary
is
like that.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, no, so then what advice do you have for other filmmakers who, I think a lot of people find themselves in that situation where they were promised access and then suddenly people don't want the cameras around or things get heated and controversial. How do you navigate that?
I think, first of all, you're not getting access. You kind of need to, I don't know if to fight, but you need to reach the access. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think usually if just someone opens you the door and says, of course, film whatever you want. So usually it comes with, okay, but I want to watch the film at the end. And for me, because I'm also a journalist, and it's like, this is my principles. And I can't break that because otherwise I'm losing my identity. So you're never just getting access. And it was interesting because you know, lots of people asking me how you made it, like how you made this unbelievable access into this club. And I was thinking how it happened, because it's very depressing when you keep coming and they keep saying no. And really, I stood so long out of the locker room with my cameraman, just stood there, and they didn't let me in. And every time the coach were telling me, Maya, let me win one game and I will let you in. But they were keep losing. Mm-hmm. And at some point I told him, listen, if I will wait till you will win, the season will be over because it seems that you are not going to win soon. So let's change it. So I'm an immigrant. I was born in Russia, and I came to Israel when I was 10. And I came to a kibbutz, which is a small community. And my mom told me, I remember it, I was 10, she told me, listen, they don't need you, but you need them. So you need to find your way into this place. And in a way, I'm trying to get, I'm dealing with getting access since I'm 10.
That's intense. That's intense for a 10-year-old.
Yeah, and actually, I was all the time trying to come in, and they always turned me down. So, and I was going out thinking what I'm doing now and coming back. Because there was a specific group in this kibbutz that I wanted to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And they keep turning me down, and I was keep coming back. And I think this feeling of being rejected, but still to try again and again and again and again. So I'm kind of used to it. I know it sounds weird, but I kind of used to being rejected.
Hey, whatever it takes.
And but for me, the reaction to that is that I'm always will come back. And I will think, because I do believe there's a way to every person. You just need to find it. You need to see what's your way, and every person is unique in that thing. You really, and you really need to understand what his fears and what is important to him, and then try to kind of to play with that. Not to play me. Maybe play is a bad word, but
navigate it maybe.
Yeah. Because for example, it was really mapping the situation. So I understand, okay, the person that can actually let me in is the coach, because everything goes to him. So I was filming him so many hours, mm-hmm. just him. So he get used to me. Mm-hmm. And then I was keep telling him, listen, Ellie, we're already filmed so much things for the film. You have to let me in that I would be able make the film, otherwise it would be so shame if we won't be able to finish the film. So I kind of dragged him into the situation and I made him my partner. He has to be my partner, otherwise it will never happen. So at some point he was worried for my film also.
He became invested.
Yeah, he has to be. And that's the thing, you're coming to a situation and you kind of, I'm always saying, you need to understand who brings you in. And that's the most important person. Because who opens you the door? And then you need to kind of learn this person and to see. And so I kind of see that he loves the camera. And yeah, and he really feel good when he speaks to the camera. And actually, I think he's an amazing character. And so I gave it to him, you know? I really gave it to him. And he became engaged. I was talking with him like our film. Come on, Ellie. Our film needs it. You know, that's the end of it.
Right. Yeah. Wow. So I welcome you to say anything, but I'm going to ask. We kind of started to get into this. You know, you did end up making a film that, in some ways, shared like the skeletons in the closet. It's like everyone kind of knew about Beitar. But maybe they didn't know how dramatic it was. And then you have characters actually saying, our society is broken, or something to that equivalent. So how has it been received in Israel so far?
So it was, the world premiere was in the Jerusalem Film Festival, which was very important to me to premiere it there. Because first I wanted to bring this film to the people that it's about them, and to give them the opportunity to watch the film. And it was accepted really good. We got 3 prizes for best directing and best editing.
Mazal
tov. And actually the Israeli president came to the premiere. Yeah. Which was also great. So it's only that now, and I'm really hoping to have a theatrical release very soon. And I guess then it will come to wider audience. So I don't know yet how, from the people that, so okay, so it was interesting. The most amazing reaction that I got from the people from the club that watched the film, they said, you just showed exactly in 100% what happened. And that was amazing. It's just everybody saying that you're not pushing your agenda, you're just showing mm-hmm. what happened. And the president, that's what he told me. And the chairman of the club and the coach and all the people that was there, they are telling me, that's amazing. You just showed exactly what happened to us. And for me as a filmmaker, that's a huge victory, because it says that if I succeeded to you know, to kind of to express how they felt and what they saw. So it's amazing. So and there was people were coming out of the film crying. Yeah. And lots of people were telling me exactly that. We didn't know that it's so terrible, that it's so bad. We're living in a bubble. We had no idea how bad it is. Because usually Beitar, of course, covered in the sports section, so. But, and you know, that's, I think, also the strength of the film, because this story has been told in, you know, in parts, in the news, mm-hmm. because it was all over. But when you're taking this, putting everything together, and telling it as a, and that's the strength of the documentary, of course, of telling one compelling story.
And a human story, not just the headlines.
Yeah. But it, exactly. And to show the people beyond the cliches, the Muslim players. What do you mean, Muslim? There is a human being beyond this. And I think it's to look at, you know, when after Jibril, they're shouting to him, fuck you and go home and treated him so badly, and then he's, you know, and then his mother arriving and she's looking at him and said, you need a haircut. He's a baby. He's 19 years old kid. And I think it's also when you're humanizing them, it makes the people feel so uncomfortable, because suddenly they're not objects, they're not the Muslims, they're human beings, and I think it's very easy to feel kind of to hate labels and images, but it's very difficult to hate a person, you know. And someone then sits next to you and he's smiling and he's, and for me that was one of the goals I wanted to show, and that's what I said to the chairman. I said to him, listen, if they will stay objects, Muslims, you didn't do nothing. Your only way to break it is to show that they're human beings, and who they are. Otherwise, you know, Zaur has this bird, and he's like his image. We are living in a world of images, and his image, I know for the most of the Israelis, they seen him, just from seeing him, they kind of shrinking from inside, because he looks a little, not a little bit, a lot like some person that maybe tomorrow is a terrorist, and that's just, you know. It's on a totally on subconscious level, and for me it was really important to break it and to put it in parts.
Yeah,
if it makes sense.
Absolutely. Wow, well, you've given me so much to think about. I'm excited to share this with
so
our.
Much.
Well, that's what we do on a podcast. We talk.
Yeah,
I'm excited to share it with our global audience. And thank you so much.
Thank you for interviewing me.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. You can watch Forever Pure on Netflix now. You can hear lots of other fascinating conversations on the art of filmmaking by finding the No Film School podcast in iTunes, and of course by visiting us at nofilmschool.com. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you can catch our Indie Film Weekly news show, which comes out every Thursday morning
and fills you in on everything you might have missed when you were busy making films. You can reach me on Twitter @LizFilm, and we are on Twitter @NoFilmSchool. See you on Thursday.